Campus FM presents Treasures from Malta. This episode was originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series, produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti.
A philosopher, a playwright, a theatre director, a poet and an author, not to mention a person who has been an influencer in the arts in Malta from decades before an influencer became a thing. My guest today has packed all of this into a very industrious lifetime that commenced its academic trajectory with PhDs from both Milan and Oxford, followed by a professorship at the University of Malta. On a parallel with his academic career, he has written and directed numerous plays. He has penned several poems and short stories in Maltese, which have been translated into foreign languages, and they've won a plethora of literary awards. He has presented and produced many radio and TV programs with his characteristic lucid and accessible style, bringing learned discussions ranging from history to language to philosophy to a wide audience in a most engaging way. For his many contributions to art and culture in Malta, he has been honoured by the Maltese state, and he has been entrusted with a number of key positions related to culture due to his deep commitment to the arts. Joe Frigeri, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Francesca. Thank you very much for your invitation.
Joe, where did you grow up and what drew you to the arts, specifically to writing and the stage?
Well, I was born and grew up in Lia, one of the three villages that form a kind of cluster in the middle of the island. Lia is well known for two things, Francesca: oranges and fireworks. It used to be a very quiet village, outside festa time, of course. There were no cars, no dust, no building going on, no noise. The village emblem consists of three oranges together with the words suavi fructu rubeo, which in simple English would mean I blush or I turn red with sweet fruit. Every house, even the smallest one, had a garden in those days, and in every garden you'd find an orange or lemon tree, sometimes both, and a well. The primary school I went to overlooked San Anton Gardens. It had a big garden, and the classrooms were full of light. Every Sunday morning, my father used to take us to San Anton. So many of the things I've just mentioned, trees, light, gardens, wells, the festa, and the harmony of village life, as I remember it, feature regularly in my poetry. At home, we were three brothers and a sister, and our grandmother lived with us. She was a wonderful person and an excellent cook. My parents had completely different characters. My mother was a very quiet person, kind and soft-spoken. My father, on the contrary, was very energetic, always busy, very ebullient. He was a strict disciplinarian with a strong, powerful voice, but he was also a great lover of nature and had a fine sense of humor. I suppose one could say that, genetically speaking, I inherited something from both my parents. So, to come back to your question, Francesca, about what drew me to the arts, specifically to writing and the theater. Well, my father was president of the Maltese Literary Society, and he presented radio programs on Rediffusion. He used to take me with him to the studios, and there I developed this urge to write something which, in his opinion, would be good enough to be broadcast. And that's what I did. So I suppose that marked the beginning, and a very humble beginning, of my life as a writer. Where theatre is concerned, I must say I was always fascinated by it. As a young boy, I loved watching theatrine at the village hall. This was an old church that had been converted into a theatre. I went there whenever I had sixpence or a shilling in my pocket and sat glued to my seat for 2 or 3 hours watching this incredible melange of melodrama, farce, satire and song. And there again, I used to dream that maybe one day I could form part of that kind of scene myself.
So clearly, when you were young, all of this, all of what would happen in your adult life was already marked out and really evident, even as a very young boy.
Indeed, that's where it all started, I think.
I wonder if the same happened with philosophy. Your academic life has been in philosophy from day one. No detours or deviations into other subjects, from what I can make out. What attracted you to philosophy in the first place?
Philosophy, Aristotle says, begins in wonder. And from a very young age, I used to wonder whether there were any answers to the questions I used to ask myself. Questions like, for example, why can't I be the same person as you? Or why can't we grow younger instead of getting older? Silly questions, you might say. But anyway, I always ask myself these questions when I was still a boy. Can I know what you're thinking? Why can't I know the future? Does a computer think? That sort of question. Then there were bigger questions like, does God exist? Or what happens when I die? Later, I discovered that these were important philosophical questions. And I wanted to find out whether and how or how they could be answered. So that explains, I suppose, why I was attracted to philosophy in the first place.
The big questions which remain unresolved, no philosopher can give you a really straight answer about any of them. They are big questions.
They're very big questions, but I used to ask myself those questions even when I was still a boy, when I was a teenager for sure. And then I said, okay, I studied three subjects at the university. I did my BA, it was a BA general, and in those days it was over 4 years. So I did my BA in English, Italian and philosophy. But in those days we also used to study, and we had exams in Latin and Greek literature. And then after that, I decided to concentrate on philosophy.
Let me tell you a little anecdote. Happened to me recently. Recently, I introduced my father to a philosopher friend of mine, and after we parted company, my dad asked me, where does he work? And I burst out laughing. I told him, Mushovyat University, it's the obvious place for a philosopher, where else? And then immediately afterwards, it struck me how sad that philosophy isn't more central to governance, economic policies, and even major enterprise. I mean, why aren't philosophers employed in our largest corporations? Why don't we have a philosopher on every major government board or agency? Joe, do you think that philosophy has a practical application? Would it improve everyone's lives if philosophers advised at the highest echelons of power?
Well, the literal meaning of philosophy is love of wisdom, so it would certainly be a good thing if we were all philosophers in that sense. But as an academic discipline, philosophy seeks truth by reasoning. Now let's have a look at its methods. Its methods include questioning, critical discussion, rational argument, and systematic presentation. So yes, in that sense, Francesca, philosophy does have practical application. And as you say, there are many areas of private or public administration that would certainly profit from the input of ideas by philosophers who have been trained in the use of those methods.
I thought as much. Joe, let's talk about aesthetics. Aesthetics is a sort of word that we bandy about, but it really can mean different things to different people. I mean, to the layman, like me, it really is all about the appearance of an object or a building, or perhaps even the structure and feeling it creates, for example, in music. But to a philosopher, it has a very precise and slightly different meaning. In a nutshell, what does aesthetics mean?
Well, as traditionally conceived, aesthetics is divided into two parts, the philosophy of beauty and the philosophy of art. In my first lecture on aesthetics, I draw a line on the whiteboard separating the various artistic genres from the concepts that we employ to talk about those genres. So, and I play this game with my students, kind of association of ideas. So, the list of genres, we start with literature, that includes poetry, of course, it includes novels, and then theatre, drama, music, dance, painting, sculpture, photography, and those are, and that list can go on, because you can add to that list, of course. And then you talk about the concepts. And the concepts that come to mind, to my students, would be more or less those concepts that enter into a definition or a theory of art. Okay, so where the philosophy of art is concerned, we look at the various definitions that have been put forward over the centuries and the way these definitions have been elaborated into a number of theories. So here are some of the concepts that my students suggest, and you will see that they do correspond to the various theories that have been put forward and defended by various philosophers over the centuries. So let's say imitation, first thing, or representation. Most of the art over the centuries we are familiar with is figurative. Okay, so you have to start with that. And Plato and Aristotle spoke a lot about that and wrote a lot about that. Plato, as you know, was rather hostile to the arts and to poetry. There's a paradox in that, because he was a poet himself, and he uses images and metaphors and myths, and he tells stories in all his, well, in most of his dialogues, let's put it that way. But art as imitation, that's the first theory. For the Greeks, they didn't have a special word for art. The word they had was techne, plural technai, which meant skills. That's important, you know, because sometimes we speak a lot about inspiration, but we forget that that's not enough. The artist also needs a skill. Whatever medium he's using, he needs to be able to use that medium skillfully to produce the work of art. But they called, for them, there was a special group of technai, which for us are the fine arts, that's what we call the fine arts, and they called them mimetic technai, that is, skills of imitation or skills of representation. But then there's another theory, and of course associated with another group of philosophers, and this is the first thing your students will tell you when you ask them a simple question: what does the word art bring to mind? Think of a concept. Most of them would say expression. Okay, so for them, art is expression. And that, again, is a theory put forward and defended by people like Leo Tolstoy, Benedetto Croce, Robin Collingwood, and so on. But then there's another definition, another theory, which looks at art as form. Then you go back to Kant, Immanuel Kant, for that, and then Clive Bell, Roger Fry, Russian formalists, and so on. And finally, there's art as an institution, George Dickey and Arthur Danto. This theory was produced in the 20th century because most of the art produced in the 20th century by abstract artists couldn't fit, they didn't fit well into the other three categories. And so this theory would say art, or we consider artworks, works that have been christened as such, now, in sort of baptized, they've been given that name, they've been recognized as artworks by curators, critics, and art collectors. So you have all these theories to deal with, and then you speak about each one of them in aesthetics, in a class on aesthetics. You weigh the pros and cons, but at the end of the day, I want to tell my students that there's always some truth in each and every one of those definitions. Each and every one of those philosophers, of those theories, have contributed in their own way to our appreciation and better understanding of what an artwork is. But you have to take them together. Otherwise, you make that mistake of saying then art is this, and you forget about the other aspects, which are also extremely important. So you say art is expression. Yes, but then you're forgetting form. Or you just say art is form. Yes, but then you're forgetting representation, and so on. So I think that a holistic view of the art world would combine what's good and positive in each and every one of those four theories. But in doing aesthetics, we also ask questions like, is it possible to distinguish between good art and bad art? Are there objective criteria on the basis of which that distinction can be made? Does expert knowledge and experience help us make that distinction? Or is it just, as the ancients and many moderns might say, is it just de gustibus, a matter of taste? Well, I try to tell my students that it's not just a matter of taste.
Absolutely, absolutely. One of the things you tell us in class.
At the end of the day, of course, you have to make your own choices, your own preference, and you're perfectly entitled to do that, and we all do it. Mm-hmm. Do that all the time. We say, I prefer this painting to that painting, mm-hmm. or I don't feel part of that movement, or I can't relate to that painting. That's absolutely essential, because at the end of the day, it's always the personal response to a work of art that's going to show whether you're engaging with it or not.
Absolutely. All this puts me in mind of many years ago when I sat through your classes of the philosophy of art as a young, far younger, a history of art undergrad. And the one thing that really stuck with me through the years is your quoting Arthur Schopenhauer, who said, "Treat a work of art like a prince. Let it speak to you first." And by this I understood that you should stand in front of a work of art and not pass judgment immediately, but allow it and its qualities to reach out to you, take it in objectively, and then start to apply your thought and your baggage of experiences and your knowledge to it. And I think I followed that advice very closely in my subsequent career. Do you agree with this approach to art assessment and criticism?
The interesting thing there is that in art appreciation, nobody can do the appreciation for you. Okay, somebody can tell you, okay, that exhibition is worth visiting, there are some lovely paintings, but at the end of the day, it's going to be your reaction, your decision. Nobody can do the appreciation for you. The painting has to talk to you, has to speak to you in a way, you know. It has to, in a way, dictate its presence to you, so that you feel part of the painting. In the presence of the painting, you can say, now I can appreciate it better because I can look at it myself, not because somebody has told me about it. And that is essential. So it is in that sense that, of course, Schopenhauer is perfectly right. Nobody can do the appreciation for you. You can read about it. You can read a review, you can read a book, but then you need to be there and look at the painting, look at the sculpture, listen to the music, because we're only talking about one genre here, but it applies to all the arts. It applies to dance, it applies to theater, you know. You might say, no, I don't like that kind of theater. It's too much in your face. Somebody might say that, others might say, but...
The thing is, if they come to it with more knowledge, let's say, or their own experience has made them feel more attuned to whatever is being represented, then of course it's going to mean different things to different people. But you talk about you need to experience the work of art yourself,
yes.
Not be told about it. And yet you have written in appreciation of, for example, Mario Buhaljar, who was professor of history of art, and the way he has written about works of art and how his writing enables one, the reader, to actually enjoy the work of art. He's instructing you how to enjoy, which I completely agree with. At times, you don't have the critical skills developed within you enough to appreciate a work of art. So if a more learned person is holding you by the hand and pointing out the qualities in the work of art which you should be enjoying, even though you didn't know to enjoy them before, That is all so good, and you've written in the Festschrift to Mario Bahajar, you've written a whole article about, a whole chapter about how one looks at works of art through the eyes of an art professor.
Yes, that article is called Looking at Paintings, and in it I show that Mario Bahajar, he's an art critic, not a philosopher, but he does it in an extremely interesting way. So he discusses all these paintings, and I've chosen five or six of them. The book contains many more. But I showed in that essay, or I tried to show anyway in that paper, that Mario succeeds in combining all the different aspects of art theory that I've been talking about. And so he looks at a painting and he discusses its representational qualities, and then at another painting, or at the same painting, where he talks about its expressive qualities. And then, taking another painting, he concentrates on the form. And then what I say in that essay is that Mario does it extremely well, because he doesn't eliminate and avoid, he doesn't neglect any of those important aspects which one has to consider in order to appreciate a work of art.
Absolutely. The book we're referring to is At Home in Art. It is a Festschrift dedicated to Professor Mario Bahajar, edited by Dr. Charlene Venner. Now, let's move on to recollect. Let's look back at your life. In 1980, you were awarded the Commonwealth Scholarship for Academic Staff. And that meant that you spent 3 years at Oxford University doing research in philosophy of mind and action. What was that period like, and do you think it left a lasting impact on your life?
Yes. I had done my first doctorate in philosophy at the Università Cattolica di Milano, in Milan. And 10 years after that, I did my DPhil at Oxford. In the first instance, it was Father Peter who said, you must go and pursue your studies in the history of philosophy and other areas at the Catholic University. And when I was there, I wrote my first book on Austin. I wrote it in Italian, and it was published immediately by Vita e Pensiero, which is the publishing house of the Cattolica. And then I came back, I started to teach. First I spent 18 months teaching in secondary schools, church schools and government schools. I also taught sixth forms at Stella Maris College. Then I spent 8 or 9 years teaching philosophy at the university. And after that, thanks to Professor Edwin Borch-Costanzi, who was rector at the time, he helped me get a Commonwealth scholarship to go and do my DPhil at Oxford, which I did. And there again, I did philosophy of language and continued studying and writing about Austin. I was a member of St. Edmund Hall. It's properly known as Study Hall. So when you get the Commonwealth scholarship, they always send you to a college. You can choose it, or they choose it for you. That's where I did my DPhil. I was there with Teresa and David. David was 4 years old, and he went to St. Aloysius Primary School at Oxford. And then I used to spend the day in the college library. That was the medieval Church of St. Peter in the East, which had been converted into a library. I had the keys to the library, so I could work there even at night if I wanted to, which I did sometimes. We lived in a small flat at number 2C Crick Road, 2 meters away from the parks. And the first trees we saw were cedars of Lebanon. David used to collect and play with conkers that fell from the horse chestnut trees. So it was lovely over there. In the evening, we used to watch BBC or ITV television. It was either snooker with star players like Steve Davis and Hurricane Higgins in those days, or Inspector Morse. It was very cold, so I used to sit on the carpet close to the fire. Once I was so engrossed by what we were watching that I didn't realize my sweater had caught fire, and I ended up with a big hole in it to prove it. My first thesis supervisor was Jim Urmson, J.O. Urmson, who died 9 years ago. He was one of the ablest of Oxford's 20th century philosophers and one of its most brilliant tutors. He lived in Cumnor, and just outside Oxford, and I used to go there by bus. I used to go to his house to discuss my work with him. The house was on top of a hill. The road was called Tumble Down Dick. At the bottom of the hill there was a huge reservoir, and they had called the house Standfast. So it was Standfast on Tumble Down Dick. His wife, Marion, played the flute, he played the piano, and before we started talking about my work, they always played a little bit of music for me and organized a kind of a small lunch. He used to say, "Joe, it won't be a party." So he knew I loved beetroot, so he used to give me beetroot. And then Teresa came with me once, and he showed us the garden. It was absolutely lovely, absolutely lovely. It was a garden that was full of trees, and the apple tree had a place of honor in the garden. It produced Cox's orange pippin apples. My wife says it's the best apple she's ever tasted. Small but very sweet. Right, and then, of course, I finished my thesis. Jim Urmson said, "Okay, Joe, now I think I can pass you on to somebody who knows a little bit more about the subject than I do," because I didn't just stop at Austin, I then discussed other philosophers as well. And I spent the rest of my time there first with Jennifer Hornsby. That was her area of specialization in those days. And I finished my thesis under the supervision of Christopher Taylor, C.C.W. Taylor. So I had these three brilliant professors supervising my work when I was at Oxford. The examination at Oxford then takes this shape. In Italy, there's just 20 or 30 professors sitting against the three walls of a room, and you're facing the examiners who are sitting up on a platform in front of you, sitting in the middle. At Oxford, it was different. You go to examination schools, you have to wear a gown, and then the scout comes and gives you coffee, offers you black coffee, and then the bell rings and he takes you down this dark corridor to the small room where your examination is taking place. And I was examined by Geoffrey Warnock, who was the vice-chancellor, who was then knighted, became Sir Geoffrey Warnock, and by Alan R. White. The interesting thing about these people is that both of them were experts in the philosophy of language. Warnock had edited Austin's works, because they had published all these works posthumously, except for a collection of essays which appeared in Austin's lifetime. Austin lived between 1911 and 1960. He died very young. And I was very happy and very, very pleased, because you could see that they liked the work.
Okay. So how did you feel walking down that corridor before you were let into the room?
Well, you know, I was confident, but, you know, you're always a bit apprehensive. You know, I don't know what they're going to ask. But we had a kind of very amicable conversation, and they said, "This is fine, we're going to recommend you." I didn't have to make any changes to the thesis whatsoever. And then eventually, when I came to Malta, that book, that second book on Austin's actions and speech actions, so it combined philosophy of mind and philosophy of language, was also published, and we're now publishing the second edition of that book.
So you've spoken about Austin as though he's a household name, which he isn't to any of us. who aren't philosophers. He was a philosopher of language, but I can understand you, that you speak about him with such familiarity, because you spent a good chunk of your life examining his studies, or examining his publications, examining his work. And you do build up this familiarity, you know, with the subject of your thesis.
Yes. Well, I was always interested in philosophy of language because I work with language all the time, and not just in philosophy, but also in my literary works. Let's call them creative works. There's creativity involved even when you're writing philosophical works and essays and so on. But yes, language I find is a fascinating subject. It's this means of communication which is shared by human beings, by all human beings, you know. And the fascinating thing about it is that you look at a dictionary, you can count the number of words in a dictionary, say 30,000, 300,000, half a million, but you can never count the number of sentences which you can produce out of those words. You can string those words together in an infinite number of ways. And that also relates to my thoughts about creativity, because at the basis of creativity, there's always language. And we, in a way, speak a different language, all of us. Okay, there's a language we share. That is, we understand the meaning of the words in that language. And that is what enables us to communicate with other people, because we know their language and they know our language and we can speak the same language. But in another sense, everybody develops their own individual way of talking and speaking, you know. So in a sense, everybody develops their own individual dialect, if you like, okay? And that's also what explains, if you like, creativity, what makes different poets produce different poems, you know, and you can say the same thing about music. What makes different composers produce different works out of basically the same number of notes? Then I looked at language as a means of communication. That is what Austin used to call this descriptive fallacy, you know, the idea that we only use language to describe things with, but that's not the case. We can do so many things with language, you know. Austin wrote a famous essay, it was an unscripted talk which he gave on the BBC, called Performative Utterances. And then he wrote a book on the same subject, or rather he gave lectures on the same subjects, which were published posthumously, prepared for publication and edited by Jim Urmson, J.O. Urmson, How to Do Things with Words. So that's a fascinating idea, is it? That is, performative utterances.
What are performative utterances?
The only way in which one can get married in this corner of the world where we live used to be just by saying, I do.
So what are laid in two words?
There's two words. There's just two words. The formula has changed a little bit, but basically that's what it is. And if I told you, I bet you sixpence it will rain tomorrow, and you say done, then you've accepted the bet, you know. And so we use language to issue orders, commands, ask questions, congratulate people, and so on. And so how to do things with words, and that was the first step in Austin's development in his philosophy of language. But then he went on to say something else. We do many things when we speak all the time. So one thing we do when we speak is produce noises with our tongue, lips, vocal cords. That's what Austin calls the phonetic act. And then we use words that belong to a certain vocabulary and follow a certain grammar. Austin calls that the phatic act. But then we also produce meanings. That is, we string sentences together and we mean something by them, and Austin calls that the locutionary act. But apart from meaning, Austin also discusses what he calls the force of an utterance, so that I can use the same sentence to achieve and produce so many different consequences and effects. So, for instance, I say, I tell you, I'm waiting for Joseph. Okay, the meaning of the words is clear. If you know the language, you understand what I mean. But the speaker's meaning, what I mean when I use those words, differs from one occasion to the next. So, I'm waiting for Joseph can mean we're going to the cinema together. Or, I'm waiting for Joseph can mean you'd better not stay with us because there's going to be a fight developing when he arrives. Or, I'm waiting for Joseph means I'm going to complain as soon as he arrives because he is always late. See, all these things which you can say just by using the same words. Right, and that brings out the force of the utterance.
It's good that you're mentioning all this, because I remember that excellent series of radio programs that you produced and presented with Father Joe Borch on Campus FM, where you looked in a really microscopic way at the meaning of individual Maltese words. And for me it was really fascinating and yet so accessible, because these were words I used and I knew the nuances of. It was just that having you lay it out so clearly and giving these examples made me consider and reflect on the richness of the language and how one word can be used in so many different ways.
Yes.
Okay, let's also talk about your literature. Joe, in reviewing your book of short stories, Il Fira tal-Fuħar u Stejjer Oħra, which translates to The Pottery Fair and Other Stories, Mark Anthony Falzon describes your prose as pared down. He says, "Readers looking for language acrobatics will be disappointed, but it is precisely the economical simplicity of words that makes these pieces so beguiling." What is your process in writing, Joe? And do you plan it all out and then commence writing? Or does your writing evolve organically and then you take the pruning shears to it?
Well, I'm inspired by what I see, hear, and feel by people and events. That's not just me. I mean, all writers are inspired by that. I'm inspired by what I read, by what I can remember. A news item, a painting, a whiff of cigarette smoke, a bit of jazz, a phrase used in casual conversation. Then back home, away from it all, I seek to elaborate the thought and to convey it to others, because that's important, by means of an image or series of images in a poem or a short story or as part of a play, as the case may be. Now, in the process of elaboration, and that's to answer your question, Francesca, in the process of elaboration, the thoughts and feelings become clearer. It's not at all easy for me to say how the work is related to the experience, but there's always some relation. In my poetry, I write about ordinary things and events. So there's always this transformation, as in all art. Okay, you can be inspired by ordinary things, but then you have to transform them, transfigure them in some way. And I use simple language to convey my thoughts, and I'm also strongly aware of the importance of rhythm as a tool for producing the desired effects.
But Joe, what I really want to know is your process of writing. Are you a very methodical worker? Do you plan out everything and then start from the beginning and elaborate on each note? Or do you work organically? You let thoughts sort of feed off from each other and then eventually go back to your writing and edit it more holistically?
Well, I think that depends on what you're writing. If it's a poem, I don't go through that process at all. It's a thought. My poems are normally short and very simple. I was strongly influenced when I was doing literature at the university by the Italian Hermetic movement. You know, just think of Giuseppe Ungaretti, "M'illumino d'immenso." Okay, just four words if you count the M at the beginning as a word and the D in the second line as a word. "M'illumino d'immenso," and I think that my style is writing short poems with one image, two images at most. That's writing poetry. So I don't really revise my poems. You know, they just
flow.
They just flow and they stay there. Maybe I can change one word, maybe. But then when you're writing a short story, that's different, because that's longer. And the most arduous task, the most difficult task, is when you're writing a play, especially when you're writing a full-length play, okay? There, you have to go through this process of organization at the beginning. So, because in a play, you have to think of characters, plot first. You know, the plot is extremely important when you're thinking of a play or when you're thinking of a story. Harold Pinter used to say, "Give me a good story and I'll give you a good play." But if you're writing a play that's a full-length play, two or three acts, that's a tougher task. You know, Aristotle in the Poetics gives you a list. This is 300 and 400 BC. It gives you a list of the ingredients which make a good play. And he starts with plot, so you have to have a good story. And then there's character, and then there's dialogue, and then there's spectacle, there's language, the language you use, and there's music, if you're using music. The Greeks always had music and dance as part of the theatrical productions. And then, of course, if you're lucky, the effect on the audience would be as you thought it would be. Sometimes you're surprised by audience reactions when you're in the theater, okay? You think that at this point they're going to laugh, and they don't. And then there's another line which makes them laugh. So you are surprised and you ask yourself, well, I never thought that they would at that stage. But so the process of writing is different in all these cases.
Let's go for a break while we hear Joe Frigeri read out his poem, Trappists.
They walk the paths of green-grey silence, trapped by garden walls, past rows of lichen-covered tree trunks, summoned to secret prayer by the bell, at dusk and dawn, with threads of thought unwoven and unspun, and piles of books still waiting to be read. This is a cloistered life, where apples, peaches, grapes have color, shape, and taste, but no familiar name, and there's no word to tell the eagle from the owl, bread from stone, a baseball from a bat, warm life from frosty death, or to describe the breathless chase of lion hunting deer, the fateful fall, the pounce, claws tearing out the flesh, and blood-stained teeth and mouth-hole dripping blood. Is this the way to nip desire in the bud? Better to feel the lemon-scented breeze ruffling the wheat on summer afternoons, or to prevent bad dreams from taking shape on frosty nights in wine-filled winter months? The air is still now. Cicadas sing. A rusty pulley creaks on an uncovered well. Miles away, trains rumble, shake the earth.
Joe, ostensibly this poem was about the secluded life of Trappist monks, and you question whether it is worth living life in that manner. But really, what is this poem about, and why do you pick on Trappists in particular?
The Trappists are officially known as the Order of Cistercians, of the strict observance, and were originally called the Order of Reformed Cistercians of Our Lady of La Trappe. That's why they're called Trappists. Now, although they pray round the clock, they're vegetarians, and They perform no less than 5 hours of manual labor daily. Now, I was fascinated by Trappist rule and wrote a poem about this because although there's no vow of silence, they don't take the vow of silence, speech is seen by them as a temptation to exercise your own will instead of the will of God. So speech is discouraged. And the poem describes the result of that practice. Well, that poem is just a poem which raises a question about the relation between language and thought. That is, if you're silent, completely silent, if you don't talk at all, then does something happen to your thought processes? If you can't express yourself, you can't communicate your thoughts, then what happens to your thinking processes? That's what I'm interested in, the relation between language and thought.
Joe, let's go to the stage, from the Trappist silence to the stage. You've produced over 40 plays, including 7 Shakespeare ones, and your productions are known for being very particular, very out-of-the-box sort of thinking. You are a playwright, and you've also written libretti for opera and lyrics for song cycles. And between 1990 and 93, you were chairman of the Manuel Theatre. So the stage is clearly in your blood, and you've entered into most of the creative roles that relate to the stage. But do you act?
No, I took part in a play twice, and the second time I was so completely and utterly disguised. You know, my hair was gelled, I was given this sort of sleeve to wear, which gave people the impression that my hand was full of tattoos. So they didn't recognize me, but I did that only once in a farce. Well, I don't act on the stage, but I think that I enjoy telling stories with friends and family especially, and that I enjoy. So I think it's like acting, you know, when you're telling a joke and you're impersonating a character, you sort of take different characters while you're telling that joke. That's a way of acting. That's how I see it. But not on the stage.
Okay. Although, you know, you've triggered a mental image now of you with gelled hair and a tattoo sleeve, which I really have to see.
How much of it is acting, you know? That is, maybe what we're doing now is also, in a way, a kind of engaging in an act, aren't we?
Of course, including lecturing. We talked about this off mic earlier. When you're giving a lecture, you're performing.
Yeah, well, Ludwig Wittgenstein invented this phrase. He used to use this word to talk about language. He spoke about language games. You know, all the games we play with language, whether we're serious or not. You know, and that is how language develops, and that's how it works. You know, I linked that up with what I was telling you before when I was talking about Austin. You know, to understand a language, to be able to speak it, is to sort of participate in a form of life. And you show the importance, you can understand the importance of language when you find yourself in the middle of a group of people who are speaking a language which you don't understand. Yeah. And you feel cut off.
Absolutely. Joe, do you only write in Maltese and direct plays with Maltese scripts?
Well, no, I've directed 8 Shakespeare plays for a Medici at San Anton Gardens. The last one I did was Merchant of Venice. So I've written all my plays in Maltese because I feel that's the way I can express myself better when I'm writing a play. Also because I feel that we need original plays in Maltese. Otherwise, we're importing the theatre all the time, you know. And we need to have plays in Maltese about what's happening in Malta now, for example.
Yeah, of course.
Or elsewhere, but they need to be in our language. And And I find that in all my productions, when I did all my plays, some were produced by me, others were produced by Albert Marshall and Mario Zoppardi, but my Maltese plays always managed to have full houses, you know, that is, people came and they seemed to have enjoyed them. I've written 5 full-length plays. 3 of them were on historical characters. Spundar Bohra Michelangelo, Caravaggio, and The Last Days of Socrates, Lania Tacinius, Swan Song. But they were not reconstructions, biographical reconstructions of these historical characters. No, I used the plot and I worked on the characters themselves. Historically, they were characters who did something which I referred to, but I sought to bring out all the time the contemporary relevance. Now, what do they mean to us? So, for example, I used the Michelangelo story in the middle of a controversy. You see, the controversy was about Renzo Piano. You know, he had just produced plans for Valletta, the theatre and City Gate, and that these plans were shelved. And so I asked that question, or rather I put it in the title of the play, Tkundar Bohra Michelangelo.
It will be another time.
Sometime maybe, you know, another time maybe, Dar Bohra. But there I showed all the sort of conflicting interests that came into that rejection. You know, so some people wanted the theater to be built exactly as it was. They wanted a replica of the old opera house. And I was one of the few who, when there was this polemic in the papers, especially in the Sunday Times, I was one of those who said, well, no, we don't want a replica. You know, we want a theatre that belongs to the 20th century and that we can relate to as a contemporary work, not reproduce something that was there 150 years ago, so be it. And then Tkundar Bohra Michelangelo turned out to be sort of prophetic, prophetic only in a way. That is, Renzo Piano was then asked to produce new plans, but unfortunately there weren't plans for the theatre.
No, they were limited to the
plans
Parliament.
For Parliament.
Yeah.
Mm. And so I think we lost the opportunity to have really something of great architectural value to fill that space, which is now called Spazio Teatro Real, but it's just what it is now, is just a space with seats. You know.
For seat Tkundar Bohra.
For seat Tkundar Bohra.
Thank you.
Who knows?
Joe, if I were to sum you up in 2 words, I would say you're a thinker and a communicator. The stage is one such outlet of your creative process, but your role both as a broadcaster of several radio and TV programs and your involvement as member of the Broadcasting Authority in the 90s meant that you were not only a practitioner but also wore the hat of a regulator. Now, how do you reconcile all these roles, you know, being an unfettered creative and also having to wear the hat of a rule-bound figure, you know, having to fluctuate between the two? Is that a problem? Is it difficult? Are you more of a creative?
Yes, absolutely. yeah, exactly. I don't think I want to be a regulator. I tried to do my best when I was asked to sit on that board. And I think we were a good group of people on that board when I was there, because we tried to judge complaints, because basically that's what you're doing there, objectively, as they came to us. So I think we did a good job, but that's not really my line. I'd much rather teach a philosophy class, teach aesthetics or philosophy of mind, philosophy of language, the history of philosophy, which I enjoy teaching very much. And I'd much rather, I don't know, write a poem, a play, a short story, or even do what I'm doing now. What I'm doing now is translate Plato's myths into Maltese, mutos, myths. You know, that some lovely stories. This is a fascinating aspect with Plato. You know, he wrote at least 25 dialogues. And we know that he was pretty hostile where literature and painting, the arts, were concerned, because he thought that poets like Homer and Hesiod gave students a bad impression of the gods. You know, they presented the gods as quarreling, fighting, cheating, murdering, you know, lying. And Plato was not happy with that, because for the Greeks, Homer and Hesiod were sort of like what the Bible is to us. You know, it was the, that's what they learned as part of their religious education, we'd call it today. And it's quite amazing, you know, he was pretty censorial where the arts were concerned, and were it up to him, had it been up to him, in Callipolis, the ideal city, which he talks about in the Republic, that's what he's doing there, he's constructing this ideal city, there's no place for poets in that ideal city. And he says, when Glaucon and Adeimantus ask him, but what do we do if somebody like Homer sort of comes to our city gates, appears there at the city gates, what do we do? And Plato says, we'll treat him politely, we'll, you know, pour oil on his head and maybe put a garland round his forehead, but then we'll politely ask him to leave. He didn't trust poets. And yet, what's fascinating, what looks like a paradox to everybody, is that Plato uses poetic imagery, poetic devices, tools of the trade, you know, metaphor, simile, and he tells stories. You know, the myths are absolutely lovely stories, and he uses those stories to make or illustrate serious philosophical points.
Joe, it seems to me that much of philosophy yearns towards the ideal. What's an ideal day for you?
I think an ideal day is a normal day. That is, where nothing unexpected happens.
Well, the fear of the unknown,
nothing unexpected happens. Well, so it's coffee and toast with my wife, and then off to work, and then doing a bit of reading and a lot of writing, because I enjoy writing. You know, that's, I consider myself lucky in that. You know, you're writing a story, you have this idea, the first line is always difficult, but then the rest seems to follow. You know, incidentally, I always use pen and paper for my creative work. I don't use the computer. It seems to me that my thought flows more. You know, if I feel that my pen is going from left to right on this page, and I see the page gradually being filled up with all this scribbling.
On that happy note, I'm going to close off the program here. Joe, thank you so much for agreeing to be a guest on this program, and you've given us much food for thought.
Thank you very much, Francesca. I enjoyed this.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Treasures from Malta on Campus FM. This was originally recorded as a podcast, and there are pictures and links to all we've discussed on the Fondazione Patrimonio Malti website under the podcast section. That's www.patrimonio.org.